When you're looking for a new computer or need help with one you already own, call 231-8000 and Madison Computer Works will get things up and running for you. Madison Computer Works, computers that work for you.
Welcome to another podcast at sliceoffice.com, brought to you by the United Steelworkers and other great sponsors like Madison Computer Works, AMS, and SNR Remodeling. Joining us now, criminal defense attorney Casey Hoff, who, of course, works in Sheboygan these days. Casey, welcome to the show. It's been a while since we've had you on a podcast.
Thank you, Sly. Good to talk to you.
Okay, let's start out with an amazing story about some racists down in the Atlanta suburbs who, after the South Carolina flag controversy and after then-Governor Nikki Haley had the South Carolina flag taken down from the State House grounds, they decided to, yoo-hoo, go out there and yahoo, take their pickup trucks and their Confederate flags and harass African Americans in the collar counties around Atlanta. This story is from ABC.
Here's ABC's Steve Osunsami.
26-year-old Jose Torres and 25-year-old Kayla Norton were crying in court today after learning they will do hard time, sentenced to 20 and 15 years in jail, respectively. Back in the summer of 2015, they weren't nearly as tearful. They were part of this group of Confederate flag supporters and pickup trucks who spent 2 days across two counties in the Atlanta suburbs threatening black families and calling them racial slurs.
They're pulling rifles out on us. Five trucks of white guys with rebel flags.
This family was throwing a birthday party for a young child and called the police. All of this happened after South Carolina removed its Confederate battle flag from the State House. Prosecutors used a Georgia law aimed at criminal street gangs to convict them. They're expected to appeal. David?
Steve Osunsami tonight. Thank you, Steve.
All right, so there's one part of me that's loving this. Every minute of it. There's another part that concerns me a little bit, that they would get this level of sentence for essentially going out and harassing and threatening, but evidently not causing any physical harm.
Right. I mean, I guess that's the controversy, if there's any controversy about this. I don't think anybody has any amount of sympathy for these two races.
Oh, no, there are many people in the Trump administration that do, but let's just put that aside.
All right. Well, most normal people don't have any sympathy for these two racists, but you're right. Is this punishment excessive? That's a question. I mean, I think whenever you're talking about, now, it was terrible what they did, obviously, this whole respect the flag group, going around and yelling horrible racist slurs at an 8-year-old's birthday party, and I believe one of them...
Yeah, something about that rubs me the wrong way.
Right. I mean, walking up to the car with guns, threatening, threatening black shoppers and parking lots. There were all kinds of things that these two did that were horrible, that were absolutely horrible. But what do you do? Does the punishment fit the crime? And one of them got 20 years in prison. The other got 15. I think one will have to serve at least 13, and the other one will have to serve at least 6. And so we're talking largely about, I mean, essentially this is sort of terrorism. I mean, that would be the argument for these sentences. These were terrorist threats, and in fact, they were actually charged under a violation of making terrorist threats, and there's Georgia's street gang law, because Georgia actually doesn't have a hate crime law. So they were charged under these different laws. On the other hand...
Interesting. You know, it's an interesting juxtaposition in a state with a racial history such as Georgia, a law that was clearly not targeting white rednecks,
okay, right, absolutely,
was used against, ended up being used against white rednecks.
I mean, this was...
Which is what always troubles me about these type of hate crime laws and this sort of thing, because sometimes they end up coming back to bite you.
Right. And usually in these types of situations, in these types of cases, even when you have a horrible scenario like this, people don't often get these types of sentences unless they've actually caused some sort of physical harm to other people. Now, people will turn around and say, well, yeah, but what about the drug laws? It's true. I mean, we have a lot of people that are sentenced for nonviolent drug offenses to terrible amounts of time in prison that are way over excessive for things that they, that obviously they shouldn't have been doing, but that they shouldn't get that type of punishment. And so I think that's where you saw a lot of the reaction to this, is was this sort of a message-sending sentence? In other words, was this judge going and saying, you know, I'm going to send a message here. This was obviously horrible. This was in the wake of Dylann Roof. This was in the wake of all of these awful incidents going down around the country and Confederate flags coming down. That may have been the case here. I mean, these are two young people, 26 and 25 years old, again, totally unsympathetic, but I'm not so sure that 20 and 15 years in prison, that, you know, that's a long time. That's a really long time.
Well, it's real clear they didn't have Atticus Finch as their attorney.
That's right. I mean, so as horrible as this was, although I will say this, when the woman was talking in court, she said, that was not me. And I guess I'm not sure what she means by that. That was not me.
Well, maybe she meant that wasn't her true character, that she was acting out of a sense of rage, or she was acting in a way that she thought she was pleasing someone else. I don't know.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, here's the thing. There is horrible racial injustice in our criminal justice system. We all know that. We all acknowledge that there's racial injustice here. So, you know, that's why people are so unsympathetic to these two, and I'm not sympathetic to them at all. But I wonder what the reaction should be in this situation. You know, I mean, I could see 5-10 years. Now, I don't know the specific facts of the case, but even that would be pretty stiff for these types of crimes. So we're talking about 20 and 15 years, and so it's a really long time in prison.
And, of course, we don't know how many times this gang law has been used and whether there would be a case that would be analogous to it.
That's right. I mean, we really don't, because this is such an unusual situation. So, but, you know, we'll see if this has similar ramifications for other cases like this around the country, as we see lots of these racial types of incidents.
Well, whether they should do any hard time or not, this case strikes me as one where a really good restorative justice program might be far better at mending these people's hearts than long prison terms.
Well, Sly, you saw some, I mean, in terms of what restorative justice would do in the courtroom, and I'm a believer in restorative justice in many situations, in the courtroom you had Kayla Ray Norton, who was speaking to one of the victims, and very tearfully so, and it seemed to be, between both of them, a very real exchange. And I know people kind of poo-poo restorative justice.
David Clark, for instance.
Soft on crime.
The Fox News sheriff.
Right, exactly. But you're right. I mean, those types of things could go a long ways, because we don't necessarily, I mean, some people deserve to be incarcerated. We understand that. But we don't necessarily incarcerate our way out of these types of problems. I mean, this seems to me to be a deep-seated racial hatred, white supremacist type attitude in both of these two that got sentenced. And I think there's going to be a lot more healing that happened by actually seeing these people and talking with them than by simply, you know, locking them up and throwing away the key, as unsympathetic as they are.
Well, it wasn't all that long ago that the Confederate battle flag was incorporated into the Georgia state flag quite prominently.
That's right.
Casey Hoff with us at SlysOffice.com. We're talking about a number of issues regarding the law. I want to ask you about this 18-year-old young man that is in big trouble. This took place in Madison. Dane County Sheriff's Office released the name of the driver from a case last Thursday night. Noah Davis, 18, of Madison, was booked into the Dane County Jail on a tentative charge of negligent operation of a motor vehicle. The sheriff's office is looking for witnesses to the crash that happened late at night. But they say, in fact, that they found multiple items in his Chevy Trailblazer that would include a pipe and other drug paraphernalia. Now, Is he going to be charged with operating under the influence?
Well, it would probably be homicide by negligent use of a motor vehicle. I suppose he could be charged with OWI, but that's basically, you know, homicide by negligent use of a motor vehicle is a far more serious offense. It's a felony. It's a homicide, obviously. Whereas a simple OWI, if assuming that it's a first offense OWI, would be non-criminal. So generally in these types of cases, at least from what I've seen, they'll charge somebody with homicide by negligent use of a motor vehicle. They might also charge somebody with OWI, but generally speaking, you're going to be, when you're talking about a homicide charge, they think they can prove that, that's enough. Because what you need, in Wisconsin, we are an any detectable amount state, which means that if you have any detectable amount of the active ingredient of marijuana in your system at the time of driving, now obviously they can't take your blood at the time of driving, but they'll take it, they're supposed to take it within 3 hours of operation. And usually they do. Usually law enforcement will take it within 3 hours of operation if they can get it. And if there's any detectable amount of the active ingredient marijuana in their system, theoretically that's enough to sustain a conviction.
But that doesn't necessarily mean that he was impaired. Now, they suspect him of being impaired for marijuana because of the, I don't know, maybe it was the manner he was driving, but also the drug paraphernalia. Well, you know, Casey, there are a lot of people that have drug paraphernalia in their car on a daily basis. They drive to work. They drive home from work.
Well, you know, and speed, I know they said speed they think is a factor in this case. If there's any sort of erratic driving or something like that, obviously that would be a factor in determining whether you have a potential OWI or whether you have a homicide by negligent use of a motor vehicle charge. But, you know, the interesting thing about that is you're absolutely right. When you have an any detectable amount state like we do in Wisconsin for restricted controlled substances, that's only for those. Obviously, with alcohol, we have a .08 standard or a .02 standard, depending on how many prior offenses somebody has. And if somebody has a valid prescription medication that's not a restricted controlled substance, then you do have to prove impairment. But if you have any sort of drug, cocaine, marijuana, anything like that, if there's any detectable amount in your system, whether you're impaired or not, it doesn't matter under Wisconsin law, which I think is pretty absurd because if we're, you know, the reason that we have drunk driving laws and impaired driving laws is specifically to prohibit people from driving while impaired. And if they're not impaired, although they may have done an illegal substance, I don't understand I understand you can get people a lot easier that way. You can convict people a lot easier that way, but it doesn't seem to jive with the spirit and the purpose of the law.
What is your approach in these cases?
Well, it depends. I mean, if somebody has marijuana in their system, then you have to attack the actual blood test result itself if there's a problem with the blood test result. So when they do the actual blood testing, if there's some way to attack and use the science of it to attack the blood test result, if it's for whatever reason unreliable or there can be any number of reasons, then you actually have to go after that blood test result itself because, you know, again, it doesn't matter. Whereas in a drunk driving case, if you have an alcohol case, and you're talking about, you know, somebody, let's say somebody drank after they drove or, somebody, you know, was on the way up and their alcohol wasn't fully absorbed into their system at the time that the blood test was actually taken compared to the time of the actual driving. There are, you know, lots of different ways where you can, you know, try to challenge the actual blood test result itself. When you have restricted controlled substance cases, you're generally left with, in most circumstances, the option of attacking the blood test. And so that's where it can become relatively difficult.
And you went to your fancy lawyering classes on how to attack those blood tests, right?
Well, I did go to a bunch of different classes on blood testing.
Fancy classes,
yes. And it's, you know what, it actually is. People think it's so simple. You just plug this, they put the blood into the machine, the machine spits out a number, and that's it.
Hey, I watch CSI.
Yeah, right, exactly. Well, they have a word for that. It's called the CSI effect, and the reason is because you're talking about situations where, there's human error. There's human error in the actual testing, in the collection of the sample, in the processing of the sample. They have to mix it. They actually... there's all kinds of things that can go wrong in this testing. So it's not nearly as simple as pushing a button and spitting out a result.
Casey Hoff with us, sliceoffice.com, talking a little bit about you got to be really careful if you're a regular marijuana user, that if you're in an accident, you could end up getting yourself in real big trouble. Even if you're not high at the moment, that in fact that you're that you're driving and have some infraction. By the way, how long does it take for it to leave your system?
It depends on the user. It depends on how often they use. Depends on their body's metabolism, how quickly they metabolize marijuana and the active ingredient in it. So, you know, it can be anywhere from a couple of hours to, you know, a lot more than that, 18 hours, 24, you know, there's all kinds of, but I will say this, the inactive ingredient stays in your system longer, generally speaking, than the active ingredient marijuana. So, but I would never chance any of that, because whenever you're talking about that, you're right, you're talking about a potential criminal charge.
How long does cocaine stay in the system?
That's usually less time. But again, all of these are really dependent upon the body's metabolism and how often they use and various different other factors like that.
I've seen a study about THC, and that modern marijuana, especially that's being sold in states where it's been legalized, has a much higher percent THC level that is not being regulated at this time. What are states doing in that situation, where people may be very, 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 very high because they're getting, you know, this high grade marijuana?
Well, what they're often doing is they're setting limits. So just like alcohol, where we have a 0.08 standard, they're setting limits. For example, in Colorado, I believe the legal limit is 0.05 nanograms, and so you're talking about a specified amount in somebody's system. That they are setting, and yeah, you're right. I mean,
they're not setting limits on THC. They're setting limits on level of impairment.
Oh, they're setting limits on the actual active ingredient of THC. So they're saying, if you have this level of THC in your system, just like if you have this much alcohol in your system, in your blood, then we're going to say that at that limit you are deemed to be impaired.
But what I'm asking though is that the state is not regulating how much THC that the manufacturers of marijuana are putting in their product.
Oh, right. No, absolutely. So that's a, you're right. I mean, that is an inconsistency.
That's quite a collision course.
It is. And there's been a lot of controversy about it. Now, I will say one thing. Colorado is bringing in a whole lot of money, and even, you know, elected officials that once opposed the legalization of recreational use of marijuana are sort of rethinking, you know, their stance on that. But you're right. I mean, whenever you have a substance that's regulated, and I think that's why even many proponents of marijuana will say, look, we believe that, you know, the government should regulate it, but they should legalize it, and therefore we can collect tax revenue and all of that, but it should at least be regulated.
This piece that I read said that the dangers of really, really high levels of THC, especially with young people who are still, their brain is still forming, is it can cause psychosis. So I suspect eventually THC is going to be regulated to a higher degree than it is now.
I think so. I think you're probably right about that. And I think ultimately it'll probably be, although currently it's illegal in Wisconsin, I think ultimately it'll be legal in Wisconsin in some form, whether that's
That's going to take some twine, if you know what I mean.
Absolutely.
Casey Hoff with us at sliceoffice.com. We're talking about a variety of issues. Our bought and paid for lawless Supreme Court ruled that law enforcement officers can take blood samples from unconscious drivers without a warrant under certain circumstances. So what do you think about our bought and paid for lawless Supreme Court doing this?
Well, it's quite a loaded question, Sly.
Thank you.
Well, when you're talking about taking blood from somebody without a warrant, that's what the Fourth Amendment generally prohibits. Now, the Fourth Amendment prohibits general warrants in cases like these, but there are certain exceptions to the warrant requirement. And the exception that the Wisconsin Supreme Court has relied upon is the exigent circumstances exception to the warrant requirement. And let me just tell you a little bit about this, just briefly about this case. There was a gentleman that crashed his motorcycle into a deer. This was in 2013. He apparently had three prior OWI convictions, so this was, he was facing his fourth offense if he were to be charged in this case. The officer smelled alcohol, I believe, but the person was unconscious and unable to give consent, and so the officer ordered the hospital to take a blood sample from him 2 hours after the crash, approximately. Now, before we had a recent, relatively recent, U.S. Supreme Court ruling in the case of Missouri versus McNeely that there was a challenge on just generally taking blood from suspects that were accused of drunk driving, because in Wisconsin, the prior law in Wisconsin was essentially that alcohol, if you had any sort of, you know, evidence of alcohol consumption or impairment, that in and of itself was an exigent circumstance, because alcohol leaves the body. It dissipates from the body. As soon as we start drinking alcohol, it automatically starts leaving our body. It's called elimination, absorption and elimination. It happens at the same time. So the court for years, the law for years in Wisconsin was that any time, essentially, that you had this evidence of alcohol in the body, that if somebody denied your consent, because officers are required to read a form, basically, that is based on what's called the implied consent law in Wisconsin, that where the officers will ask, will you submit to an evidentiary chemical test of your blood or your breath, whatever they choose to do. And at the end of this, these warnings, if you say no, the law prior to this was that police generally could force a blood draw, meaning that they could hold you down in a hospital.
Yeah, I remember when
this, in your arm.
I remember when this was first debated.
Absolutely. So then finally the U.S. Supreme Court came out with this case called Missouri versus McNeely that said, you can't do that. You've got to have a reason. There's got to be an exception to the warrant requirement. It's not good enough to just say, oh, somebody's had alcohol, therefore, in their system, they've been driving, therefore, we can take their blood. Now, I'm oversimplifying the point. So now this case came down, and the Wisconsin Supreme Court, in a divided opinion, where we have Justice Abrahamson dissenting, along with Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, the majority of the Supreme Court said that they had enough. There were exigent circumstances in this case.
And all right. Well, let me, Chief Justice Patience Rogensack, partisan Republican, writing for the majority, said that the circumstances in this case met the criteria for a warrantless blood draw because the situation was urgent. She wrote that the deputy could have reasonably believed that waiting for House to receive medical attention to test the blood would destroy the evidence. Justice Abrahamson, who should be the Supreme Court chief, wrote the dissent, arguing that implied consent is unconstitutional because consent cannot be given by unconscious drivers. Abrahamson also wrote that the majority opinion did not meet the heavy burden necessary for warrantless blood draws. Further, she wrote that the deputy in Howe's case would have had adequate time to get a warrant.
Right. And I agree with her, because when you look at these cases, ever since the U.S. Supreme Court case we just talked about came down, what officers have been able to do is get warrants very, very quickly. So let's say somebody gets pulled over for drunk driving. They say, no, I'm not going to consent to a blood draw. Believe me, I've seen this on many different occasions, that officers can very, very quickly get warrants. They will often do, they can do a telephonic warrant, which means they call a judge, they give the information, they essentially have a form filled out for warrants. Well, they say, oh, I noticed bloodshot eyes, I noticed slurred speech, and, you know, you check the boxes. And if a judge finds probable cause, which oftentimes they do, then they can get that warrant very, very quickly, essentially email it, you know, send it back to them electronically, and it's signed. Other times, judges are often on call in these counties, and so the deputy will go over to the judge's house, and it would take, I don't know, maybe 10 minutes, something like that, to get the actual warrant.
Right. So, well, especially with the technology that we have now. Let me ask you. Let me ask you this. What are you most concerned about with this ruling and its potential abuse?
Well, I think that anytime you have a situation where somebody's facing a potential criminal charge and you're not able to gather their consent, you ought to need to at least get a warrant. I mean, that's the whole point of the Fourth Amendment. We're not supposed to just make this easy for people or easy for, for prosecutors to get convictions in these cases. That's not the point of the Fourth Amendment. Is it going to be a little bit harder for them to get blood from people that are unconscious? Yes, but it should be. I mean, it absolutely shouldn't be an easy thing to get somebody's blood, just like it shouldn't be an easy thing to go into somebody's house. We could easily say, we're just going to get rid of the Fourth Amendment and allow police to go into houses based on, not based on probable cause or not based on consent, if they have some sort of reason to believe the person might have drugs in the house, because maybe they'll flush the drugs down the toilet. And actually, courts have found that in certain circumstances, just like I'm talking about, that there's an exigent circumstances exception there too. So we keep on chipping and chipping away at the Fourth Amendment and finding more and more exceptions. I find that problematic.
In summation, Counselor, what you're saying is that our lawless, bought and paid for Supreme Court has a pre-1776 view of the Fourth Amendment.
That is an interesting way to put it, Sly. But remember, I have to appear potentially before the Supreme Court.
But you're all right. Then let's put it in the words that you could write in a summation. You're deeply troubled by their decision.
I'm deeply troubled. That's okay. A great way to put it.
Okay. Criminal defense attorney Casey Hoff. If somebody needs your help, wherever they are in the state, and I know people listen to these podcasts all over the place, what is your phone number?
920-234-2222.
All right. Criminal defense attorney Casey Hoff, thanks for coming to SlysOffice.com, brought to you by the United Steelworkers.
SlysOffice.com.
Thanks a million.
Bye-bye.